Hey guys, this is Nita and you're listening to Underground. Me, I'm just a fellow DJ producer and together we're going to learn from the best around the world. So today I have a guest from my very own country and I'm super excited to have him. He is an award-winning DJ and a record label owner. He has toured alongside names like Martin Garrix, David Guetta, Kygo and more. I bring you Anish Sood. Hey Anish, how's it going?
Hi Nita, I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very excited to have you because you are an award-winning DJ, producer, songwriter, and one of the first few artists to break through in the dance music scene in India. Your track Castle was persistently on top 5 on iTunes in India. You've also played at some prestigious festivals like Tomorrowland, Sunburn, Electric Daisy Carnival. Then you co-wrote the song Be Nice, which then won an award on an NBC show called Songland. And then it also got released by Black Eyed Peas later. And that's not it. You also won an Independent Music Award in New York for your track Starry Night. And then you also opened a record label called Classic Action, which releases and deals with house music. How have you done all of this?
Okay, start from the beginning. All right. Well, I got into dance music when I was 15 or 14 maybe. And my first entry point to dance music was Armin Van Buuren's State of Trance podcast. And I was 15, was like, what? 2005, 2004, maybe. Uh-huh. So trance was really big back then. And there were like a bunch of like really big trance acts who had like all these radio shows, Above and Beyond, Marcus Schulz, and you know, all these guys. That's really kind of what got me hooked to it. I had like a long commute to college. I went to engineering college, which was like an hour away from home. So every other day I would like load up. I didn't even have an iPod. It was like this tiny MP3 player, which only had memory for like 2 podcasts. Every 2 days, I would have to download new podcasts. And then I just started listening to them on the way to college. And that's kind of what my entry point and beginning into electronic music was, you know. So I was always fond of collecting music. I come from a family with a lot of musicians in them. My uncle and dad are both jazz guitar players. So I was very fond of music. I never studied music or took any music theory classes. But I collected a lot of music. So I had CDs, I had cassette tapes. And generally, when you collect anything, the natural urge is to share that with people. Because I mean, there's no point collecting and just keeping it all locked up. So
yeah.
I would always be that kid, you know, in the corner at the tape deck, like playing the music or changing the cassettes or whatever, or deciding which cassette goes in where and stuff like that. So when I got to college, I started experimenting with DJing. I didn't really know too much about it, but because the podcast got me hooked and I started digging deeper into them and seeing, you know, what is happening and like, what is all of this. I downloaded Virtual DJ, which is a great starting point, I think, for almost everybody.
Yeah.
And I got myself a controller and then I was just doing these like parties in my college room. Then from there on, we started doing parties off campus for like kids in college. And then we started booking DJs who play in clubs that go out to come and play at these parties. And then I was opening for them and they started then booking me to play at clubs in Goa. And, you know, then that's kind of where everything started. And then, you know, once I got into the club circuit, it was just like meeting people and
How old were you then? When you had your first gig, how old were you?
I was 18.
So how was your first gig? Were you terrified? Did you enjoy it?
To be honest, I don't have like a definite memory. Like I would say actually my first kind of like gig in playing in front of people was at my 10th grade like graduation party. Mm-hmm. When I was like 15 or 16 and there was no DJ equipment. So I had like one Discman, you know the Discmans?
Yeah,
like the
yeah.
Sony Discmans.
Yeah.
I had one of those and my friend had one, so I was like, you bring yours. And basically, we would play a song. And then when the song finished, we would put the volume down. We would remove the cable from this one, connect it to that one, and then put the volume up again.
You know? Oh my God, that's damn creative.
So maybe that was my first gig. But yeah, my first club gig, I do remember my first club gig. It actually went really well. I was opening for another DJ, and it was like a pretty full house. And I'd like to think that I didn't mess it up too much. I hope I didn't.
I bet you didn't. So how do you release a track? Like how often do you release a track? How do you produce on such a large scale? Or like
it's
how
so
do you do it?
Weird. You know, it's so weird. Like I've actually had like a really big problem releasing music. Like my ratio of the tracks that I produce to the tracks that actually get released is so bad that sometimes my manager just like calls me and he's like, man, like, what is the point of sitting with all this music and you're never going to put it out? I've probably got like 50 or 60 unreleased songs that are just sitting on my computer, completely finished, and they haven't been released.
Why not?
And then it's also just, it's just a combination of timing, right factors, you know, sometimes some of them were made 3 years ago and that sound doesn't work anymore. You know, I've changed, evolved musically as an artist and I don't associate with that sound anymore. So
yeah.
I'm not comfortable putting it out. It's just a myriad of factors. And it's weird because like from 2012 to 2018, I would put out like maybe 3 or 4 releases a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2019, I didn't put out any music at all. And then in 2020, this year, I've already put out like 6 songs.
Wow.
So it's just like, it's very weird. But I mean,
did you make these 6 songs this year or have you been working on it for a while?
Yeah, like some of them were this year. Some were from last year. Mm-hmm. Some were from 2018. So it's just a mix of everything. Yeah. Like I still have a couple of like great songs from 2017 that I'm just, you know, kind of waiting for the right moment to drop, I guess.
So how often do you sit down to like produce? Like as an artist, do you always feel productive and motivated and, you know, or do you feel lull?
No, I again work in bursts. So like I'll go through a burst of like 2 weeks where I'll make 10 songs or I'll finish like a ton of work. And then for like 3 weeks, I won't do anything at all. Usually when I mean in normal times, you know, when we have gigs and when we're touring, that's a big problem because if you go out on a weekend and you play like 2-3 shows in like 2-3 different cities, by the time you come back, you're so tired, you take 2 days to like recover and acclimatize, you know, to getting creative again. So generally like the hard touring months, which is like October to December, Jan, Feb, March, the output is really low. I'm usually just trying to finish projects that are already started.
Mm-hmm.
Unless, of course, there's something with a deadline, which is a remix or, you know, like a commission for someone or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I generally tend to write my music in this time of the year. So for the past like 2 years, not this year, but because of the pandemic and all, and well, not last year as well, but 2017, 18, mm-hmm. I go to LA every month for like for the summer. I have a huge network of like songwriters and producers who I work with there.
Mm-hmm.
I just go for a month and work on like 15, 20, 25 songs and then come back and slowly finish them over the course of the year.
Wow. So do you have like a specific genre that you would rather prefer to produce or like you're open to everything?
Primarily house. I'm essentially a house DJ and a house like music producer. But I mean, I veer from house to techno. And then I also veer on the other side to like disco. So I'm kind of somewhere in the middle of, you know, soul, funk, house, disco, techno. And like my sets are also all between the three of them. But I generally like stay away from anything that sounds super cheesy on the pop, funk, disco side. And I stay away from... on the techno side, anything that sounds super dark, because that it just doesn't work for my sets.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And speaking of sets, I have a very interesting question that I've been dying to ask somebody.
Yeah.
As a DJ, when you get booked so much and you have so many shows almost every second day, how do you make your sets? Like they all have to be different. Do you repeat your songs? How many sets do you have? Like how do you have something on such a large scale?
Well, so the way I operate, and I know a lot of like really big international DJs operate the same way, is that I have a pool of 600 to 800 tracks that I'm working with currently on like the macro level. And then within that pool, I have a pool of 50 to 100 tracks that are like my absolute go-tos. I don't plan any set in advance. Everything is completely on the spot, but confined within these pools of tracks, essentially. Unless, of course, I want to drop a classic track or I want to drop a track from like a very specific track, say from 2009 or 2010, you know,
mm-hmm.
then I'll go and find that. But it basically every like 2 weeks or every, well, not every 2 weeks, I look for music every week mm-hmm. in when touring is going on and stuff like that. My music discovery happens between promos and Beatport.
Mm-hmm.
So like every week I'll download maybe 10, 12 or 15 tracks and then add those to the pool. And then slowly at the end of the month, remove the older tracks from the pool to keep myself fresh.
Right.
And then within that space, I also play by key.
Right.
So I use mixing key. So like all the mixing is harmonic.
Yeah.
It just makes your mixing like super smooth and like very, very fluent. You can't even tell the mixes, you know, happened.
Okay. Now I have a production question.
Yeah.
What DAW do you use to begin with?
I use Logic as my primary DAW. Mm-hmm. All of my writing and composing and production happens in Logic. Mm-hmm. And I use Ableton for my for radio sets, if I have to like make a DJ set to organize that.
Mm-hmm.
And I also use Ableton for like edits and mashups and stuff like that. Or sometimes if I have to warp a sample, because I find like warping samples is easier on Ableton.
Yeah, I like warp on Ableton as well. It's really cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you start, say you're starting a whole new project, what do you begin with? Like, what are your processes?
I really like starting with a baseline. For me, I feel, especially if it's a dance track or something that I am designing to play on floors,
mm-hmm.
I feel that, well, basically people only dance to the bass, right? You dance to the kick drum and to the bass. Nobody dances to hi-hats because that'll make you look really funny. Or like nobody dances to vocals. So if you want to make an effective dance floor track, your kick and bass is really just what you need to get sorted first. So I will usually start with the bass line. I then start designing my kick. Mm-hmm. I don't use kick samples. I use this plugin called Kick 2 by mm-hmm. Sonic Academy, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so. But that basically lets you, it's like a kick synth. So it mm-hmm. lets you make your own kick. So I start from scratch for every track and I'll make a kick for that track.
You basically make it in the same key. What do you do?
Like? Yeah, exactly. So you start, I usually start with the sine wave or sine wave. And then I'll compress that and make sure it's in the same key. Probably layer a couple of them on top of each other. Mm-hmm. Sometimes use like a click sample on the top of it. It just depends on, you know, how much I want the kick to cut through the mix, or the kick is really driving the track here, or the bass line is driving the track, and kind of give each of them enough headroom to kind of coexist together, like happily.
Okay, so when it comes to production, what is something that most people do is something that you think is cringeworthy or is not correct? It's like a massive mistake and everyone does it. Like, what should we avoid?
I think people overcompress a lot. There's this huge misconception that louder the track, the better it is, and your tracks need to be really loud. And that you need to compress them to make them louder. That's not true. Compressing them only makes them sound like thinner, and like you lose a kind of raw feel and you lose the transience and the dynamic, which is what really counts. And it actually doesn't matter if your track is loud or not, because if you're making music to be played on dance floors, any good DJ who's playing your track has a gain knob on his mixer, and if the track's soft, he's just going to increase the gain and like match it with the gain of the other track, right? So it doesn't really matter. And I feel like a lot of people lose the overall process of production and the final output, and they kind of lose that, you know, rhythmic touch or the groove, so as to say, the track has,
mm-hmm.
just because they're trying to make it sound harder, louder, more compressed, more distorted, and, you know, just like really in your face. And that's something I try and avoid as much as I can.
So when you do compress, what instrument do you end up compressing most of the time?
So I compress my kick within that plugin I mentioned itself.
Mm-hmm.
I compress my bassline. I end up using sidechain compression quite a bit for the bassline.
Mm-hmm.
And then I use bus compression to compress every bus individually. So I'll compress my drums together. But again, I'm using something called the glue, which is, Ableton has that too. It's an emulation of the SSL G-Bus, the 4000 compressor. So it's not a very like squashing compression. It's more like a subtle, let's put everything together and like slowly raise the level kind of compression. And then on the final master, I use this incredible compressor from UAD. It's called Shadow Childs.
Sorry, what is it called?
It's called Shadow Child.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's like a legendary like mastering compressor. But again, it's very, very gentle. It's just more for the character and the sonic sound of the compressor. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I may be just compressing maximum like 1 dB or 1.5 dB. Sometimes 2, but not even 2. After that, I use a lot of people end up using a limiter in the final step. But I don't use a limiter. I use something called a clipper. So what a clipper does is just it sets levels for you, and then anything which goes above the transient peaks just clips off. So what you get is a cleaner signal, as opposed to
instead
a limiter
pushing it down.
Yeah. So it's think of it like
But then don't you lose sound when you clip off the high ends?
You do. Yes. Well, it's not only the high end. It clips off the loud parts. Whatever is too loud, it clips off. So you do lose that, which is okay because it was too loud anyway to begin with. It was never going to fit in the signal. But the difference between a clipper and a limiter is that a limiter is taking all these extra loud signals and pushing them back into the mix.
Right.
Yours is clipping it off. So you have to know how to use a clipper. If you use it too much, then you lose too much of the audio.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that by the time you bring a signal to the clipper, it's already compressed enough that whatever is getting clipped off is really unnecessary.
Okay.
So it's actually just making your sound like cleaner.
Yeah. When did you start producing?
I started producing when I was 20. No, 2008. So 12. Okay, like 19 maybe.
So 2 years into DJing basically.
Yeah, absolutely. So I very quickly realized, you know, as soon as I got into DJing, I started getting into music that production is going to be important, and like people will only recognize you if they know your music.
Mm-hmm.
So I took it upon myself. I taught myself how to play the piano. I started watching YouTube tutorials. I've never had any formal training in music production at all.
Are you now well versed with music theory because of being able to play the keys?
Again, well, I don't know the theory of music because I can only play by the ear.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know the theory of music production, which I just learned reading books, reading YouTube, watching YouTube videos.
If you could recommend some books that you read.
Yeah.
For anybody who's
favorite,
struggling.
Yeah, my favorite book, which deals with the technical aspects of production, is this book called The Mixing Engineer's Handbook.
Oh, of course, I've heard of this. Yes.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. It's just such a nice book. I still have a copy lying around in my studio, and if there's something I ever like, you know, don't understand, I just go and like look at it again. It's great. And I've got all like everything highlighted, and like I feel like everyone should just have a copy with them, you know, lying around, because very often we try and do things or we perceive a certain particular process in the production space, and we just click and make these changes because we think it sounds good,
mm-hmm.
Which is cool. I feel like that's how you should produce, because at the end of the day, you want to produce stuff that makes you feel that it sounds good. But somehow you can be making very inherent flaws also, you know, so especially when it comes to some of the finer things like, you know, transients or sample rates or bit rates and like some of these like jargon kind of things, which honestly are pretty important, but it's not at the forefront of people's conversations because it's too nerdy and glitchy to talk about. So nobody will come and tell you, you know, that okay, your sample rate's wrong, or you know, or your samples are not matching, or something is wrong with them. And that can end up affecting your overall like output and mix, you know.
Yeah.
For example, like something I noticed very, very often, and it's a huge mistake I used to make all the time as well, until like a friend of mine pointed it out, is like phasing. You know, you have very often you have two stereo channels on your bass line,
mm-hmm.
but they both are in the same phase, so they're canceling each other out. So you have like a certain frequency, like 40 hertz, which is phasing, and that entire frequency gets eliminated, you know.
Uh-huh.
But unless you know that you have to check for phasing, you'll never mm-hmm. know. So I've had tracks that I've put out maybe like 8 years ago, which I can now go and listen to and tell that, oh my God, the bass line is phasing and I wish I could fix it. But that's the problem with music. Once it's out, you know?
Yeah. So do you ever regret putting anything out?
No, I don't think so. But I generally, the way I operate is that when I'm working on a song or when it's about to finish or like when I'm close to finishing it, I will listen to it like on loop a lot in the gym, in the car, you know, when I'm working out or whatever, to just make sure that I'm not missing anything or if there's anything I can change. But once it's out, I don't like listening to it because if there's something that I hear that I know I can't change it, you know?
Yeah.
So I'll play it out in my sets, but I like try and not listen to it, you know, when I'm like sitting and chilling or like relaxing or whatever.
So what were the things that you struggled with, like when you sat down to produce, or maybe when you were new, like what were the things that you really had to work on to like overcome them?
I struggled with a lot of things, actually. I think I struggled with pretty much every aspect of production. Like my initial tracks were so bad. I started producing on Reason. So the thing with Reason was Reason had a lot of synths built into it. And it was actually a very cool piece of software. It had very unique sounding synths. But the problem is that most of the synths sounded really cheesy and they sounded pretty bad. So for the initial like 2-3 years of me producing, I didn't even know that something called like soft synths and external synths in VSTs exist. So I was just like living in this entire cheesy Reason world. And yeah, like some of the music sounds really bad. That's when someone told me that, you know, by the way, you can download samples. Yeah. And to make the problem worse was that Reason did not support VST synths.
Oh, okay.
So even if you wanted to use something, you couldn't. So that's when I moved to Logic, and then it was just a whole new world, you know, of like, wow, you can like get all these synths and then you can get these samples. And back then, Silence was really big. Massive was really big. So, you know, I got all those synths. And then then my sound design evolved. Then I also kind of learned how to synthesize sounds. You know, if I want a particular sound, instead of going through like 100 patches and searching for it, you know, can I just make it? So then I started to teach myself synthesis and then ended up making sounds that sounded unique and not super, you know, generic. I also really struggled with mixing. You know, it took me like a while to just get my kick and bass to sit together. Because also I was not working in a treated room, so you know, I didn't have the right setup. I wish the biggest, if anybody asked me, the biggest revelation that I've learned in the past year or maybe year and a half, and I wish this existed when I started out, but it didn't, is this plugin called Sonarworks.
Okay.
I don't know if you've heard of it.
I have not heard of it, no.
Okay, after this call, you should go check it out immediately.
I will.
It's basically like a room correction software. And you buy it and they send you a mic and then you run all these tests with the mic with the plugin. And then it will calibrate your speakers to match your room to give you a flat signal. There have been some softwares that used to do this in the past and tried to do this. But I mean, Sonarworks does it on a level which like is insane. So like, I mean, you can see I have a pretty like treated room. You know, it's supposed to be fully flat, but I still came in and the final like 25% of correction still comes in from Sonarworks. And it makes such a big difference because now I know, like I'm confident of the fact that if something sounds right on my monitors, I can like put it out, you know, it's good to go. It'll work on any dance floor. It'll work on any system because you know, you have that confidence that your system is referenced. But when you're mixing on a system that's not that great and has flaws, then every time you listen to your mix on a different system, you'll hear something else, and then you wouldn't know where to like go and fix what. I actually recommend a lot of people starting out. I'm like, listen, if you can't, you know, afford decent monitors and like some room correction, just mix on headphones, you know, because headphones, they won't lie to you. They're very, very transparent. You can use Sonarworks with headphones also to make them sound super flat. They support most like headphones. Just mix on a platform that you're confident with, basically.
Well, that's really helpful. I'll definitely check it out.
Yeah.
What has been the hardest part of your learning journey?
Hardest part of my learning journey, maybe like music theory, you know. It took me, because I never studied music, and I went to guitar classes as a kid and I hated it. And I still can't play the guitar to save my life. But when I started writing music, and you know, and I started getting into the rooms with like all these really like talented writers and singers, and you know, they would just be like, "Well, just play me an F sharp minor, you know, or like play me A7, you know," and like we'll start there. And I'm just like, fuck, I don't even know how to play this chord, you know. Like I had to pull up Google and like very embarrassingly like fumble around and like find the chord. And then that's when I kind of realized, I was like, listen, if I'm doing this, you know, and I want to make music and I want to be a musician, I can't not know music, and like I can't not know how to play an instrument. And I think that's, again, a big mistake a lot of producers starting out today make, because they're not trained musicians to begin with. And, you know, they want to make music, which is great. I think everybody should be making music. But to be like a great producer, you have to invest some amount of time to just learn music itself, you know, because you can't be a musician without being able to like, you know, understand music. You don't have to go and like take Trinity like piano classes, or you don't have to like go and, you know, learn how to read and write theory. But I mean, you just need to know the basics of like how chords work, how chord structures work, you know, what minors are, what majors are, what inversions are, flats are, you know, and like what sounds good together, what sounds better, or, you know, stuff like that. And I think that took me like a while. And then I also, like, once I started investing some time and energy into that, I think that for sure dramatically improved my songwriting. And like, it gave me, like, melodically, it gave me the ability to like translate my ideas like way better than I could.
So when you're producing and you're making your bass lines and melodies and they have to complement each other, without theory, how did you figure that out?
So when I started off producing, I started producing with a very close friend who's like a childhood friend. Mm-hmm. And thankfully he studied like grade 6 Trinity piano. Like he was like a piano wizard. The way we used to work was that he was not very good at like drums and, you know, arranging things and, you know, finding the presets and all that. Uh-huh. So I said, you sort the bass line and the melody and the chords and all of that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you make all these layers and you send them to me, and then I'll choose a good patch for everything, and, you know, and I'll like organize it all together. So that was my trade-off. But then I also quickly started, you know, learning, and like I was seeing what he was doing. You know, I was like, okay, he's playing like a C minor chord, and then he puts the bass line in C. So I was like, okay, cool, like I get the hang of it, you know, I understand what's happening here. And then I started listening to a lot of music and, you know, like looking at what other people are doing at the same time, watching tutorials and, you know, just trying to figure things out.
So when did you discover your love for underground music?
So, you know, the funny thing is, like, I've been asked this question before, and it's really funny, because when I got into dance music itself was underground, right? And like, I actually just found my CD wallet. Wait, I'll show it to you. Hang on.
You'll have to describe it because the listeners can't see.
Oh, right. Of course. Yeah. Well, I went to my parents' house, and this is my CD wallet when I just first started playing in clubs in 2008. So you can like basically like look at all these like CDs here, which are like,
oh my God,
all
he has a lot of CDs. They're neatly categorized. And they have titles
and basically back then when you were playing on CDs in clubs, and you had these like lights on your CD case. So the only way to know which are the good tracks in the CD, I had highlighted them with like a yellow marker, you know?
Oh, okay.
But if I like look at this now, and I'm just, like, you know, like looking at some of this, so there's Eric Prydz here, there's Dirty South, there's Faithless, you know, there's Steve Lawler, Roy Ksopp, Trent Imhotep, James Abela, Cascade. So, I mean, these are all like names that you would call underground now. But these names were kind of like there was never this distinction in dance music between underground and commercial, right? Mm-hmm. All of that kind of happened in 2012 and 13 after your whole like big room, like the Swedish House Mafia and David Guetta and, you know, all these people becoming pop. Mm-hmm. But before that, like when I got into dance music, a lot of these people who are making like house music, you know, then are making techno now. And that's just an evolution of the scene, right? I feel like artists evolve, their tastes evolve. Artists also evolve to kind of see what's working and what's not working. Like, I mean, nobody wants to be like playing a genre that nobody listens to and like doesn't get booked. So at some level, as much as people like don't admit it, I think everybody also kind of works with their sound to make sure it fits with what's current, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the music I grew up listening to and like I started first DJing is very underground. So I don't think it was ever a question of like whether I, you know, drawn to the underground. I just feel like along the way I also ended up playing a lot of commercial gigs and like you know, playing a lot of pop stuff and producing a lot of pop stuff on the way. So I feel like it was just a constant journey which kind of happened back and forth. And now I'm trying to sit somewhere in between, you know. I'm like trying to figure how I can use, you know, pop leaning vocals or pop hooks on more underground production.
That's really cool idea. You should do that.
Yeah, that's what the plan is.
Okay, I look forward to hearing that. And tell me about the award you won in New York. How did that happen?
It was somebody sent us a link saying that, hey, you guys should apply for this award because, you know, like it's an independent, it's not like a Grammy. Grammy comes from the Academy Association, and like, you know, it's a whole process to kind of get into it, and you have to like, you know, apply and you know, be vetted by all these different bodies. But this is a little more simpler, where you can just go online and they accept submissions for a short period of time and they get tracks from around the world, and then an independent jury selects these tracks. And when we did get to the nominations, which is like the top five shortlist,
mm-hmm.
I like asked my manager, I was like, you know, hey, should I like, you know, is it worth flying to New York to like potentially collect? Because we heard some of the other tracks in the nominations. They weren't that nice.
Uh-huh.
So I was like, I was a little optimistic about my chances. But then my manager was like, you know, you can do that, but you know, if you don't win, then you'll just like lose all that money on the trip. And I was like, yeah, but I was like dilly-dallying in my head. I was like, okay, sure, I maybe could go. I'll still get a weekend in New York out of it. You know, it can't be that bad. I'll like meet my friends, meet some family, etc., whatever. And then by the time I actually came down to making that decision, we had already got like 2 gig inquiries for that weekend in India. So then, because it was like in the middle of touring season, you know, and it was just like one of those weekends that was left open, and then it got booked. It's like these inquiries came in, and then it was just a question of like, okay, do I also leave these gigs now and then potentially go to maybe not win, you know?
Yeah.
And then we didn't go. I didn't go. And then I just watched like the live stream, and like they announced my name, and then someone went and picked up the award for me. But it was cool. They were sweet enough to like mail us the actual trophy.
Yeah.
So it's lying somewhere at home. It was fun. Yeah. In retrospect, the takeaway from that is when you're nominated for something cool, just go for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because then I felt really bad too, because I was looking at the live stream, and then there were all these like cool people and celebrities like hanging out there.
And, you could have met people and done some.
So many musicians were there, and then I was just like, oh my god, I'm an idiot. You know, and then they had this like kind of private after party for everyone who won an award, and like everyone was kind of hanging out in that.
Oh man.
Yeah, but it's okay. We learn.
Yeah, we learn. Also, having achieved so much that you have, what would you say to somebody who is just about starting out?
Like, obviously, the first thing is like don't compare yourself to anybody else, and don't be daunted. I don't even like look back and think about like some of the stuff in the past. Like for me, my constant motivation is, you know, what can I do next? There's really no point like sitting and dwelling on, you know, what you have achieved or you haven't achieved, and the opportunities that worked out or the opportunities that didn't work out. All you have is what you can do right now to change what you can in the future, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the biggest power that someone who's starting out has is that they have a clean slate in front of them, and they have like literally the ability to shape whatever they want by the actions in the present. So don't think too much about the fact that, oh, I haven't achieved enough, or mm-hmm. that I'm just starting out. Instead, focus on actually putting in the effort and the work to change things.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly you'll be like 5 years into it, and you'll look back and you realize that, you know, you've achieved enough.
All right. Yeah. This was really fun. I think I learned a lot personally, at least, for sure. There are lots of things I'm going to go check out. And thank you so much for talking about so many things. That was very, very helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me again.
Okay, so that was Anish Sood from India. And if you guys have any sort of questions that you would like me to ask my guests on the episode, please send me voice messages or text messages. If you want to send me voice messages, you can do that by clicking on the link below. And I will see you guys next Friday. Thank you for tuning in.